Welcome to the Medicine Matters Diabetes Podcast. This year's EASD annual meeting was held in a virtual format because of the ongoing pandemic, but still featured plenty of new research. Our editorial board got together from their different time zones to talk over the most interesting presentations. In the order in which they speak, they are Sanjay Kalra, an endocrinologist from Karnal in India, John Wilding, a diabetologist and obesity specialist from Liverpool in the UK, and Laurie Berard, a nurse consultant from Winnipeg in Canada. We begin with Sanjay, explaining why the findings of the EMPEROR-Reduced and DAPA-CKD studies are equally important for diabetologists, cardiologists, and nephrologists.
It's important news for everybody. It's important news for every person on earth. Because as we see, the epidemic of modern disease, the epidemic of metabolic diseases, is not limited just to diabetes or to obesity. It encompasses cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease. The cardiovascular disease can occur from other causes apart from diabetes. And chronic kidney disease also, the main cause may be diabetes today, diabetic nephropathy or diabetic kidney disease. But there are other causes of kidney disease. So this news is good news for everyone. Speaking from an endocrine perspective, it adds confidence to what we've already been doing. It adds confidence and it supports what we've been learning over the past few years. Speaking from the perspective of a cardiologist or a nephrologist, the fact that their colleagues in endocrinology have been using this drug or this class of drugs for the last few years, that adds confidence to their practice as well. And I think we all need to work together. The main challenge that I see, and I'd like to ask Laurie and John their idea, the main challenge is not going to be in using dapagliflozin or empagliflozin or canagliflozin. It's the main challenge is in knowing the contraindications, when not to use these drugs. And secondly, how to monitor them. We should be able to know the red flags. You know, what are the flags for acute kidney injury? What are the flags for hemodynamic decompensation, for dehydration? And then we should be able to act in a manner which promotes health rather than causes side effects. If we work together, if we all use the same language, this is quite easy to do. The fact that EASD has been chosen, it's a diabetes conference that has been chosen to present this data, it means that this is important news for us.
Sanjay, I think those are really important points. And I think you're right. If you think about, for example, DAPA-CKD, the reality is that those people went into that trial because they had chronic kidney disease and eGFR between 25 and 75 and or proteinuria. And even the people with diabetes, a lot of those people had kidney disease that was not due to their diabetes. They had hypertensive nephropathy or microvascular nephropathy or other nephropathies. And so although it may be relevant to people without diabetes, it's also relevant to people with diabetes because a lot of people with diabetes actually have non-diabetic renal disease. And that was a really important point that I think came out in that study. And that's in some ways why it's a little bit different from what we saw from Credence, because Credence was people with diabetic nephropathy who had proteinuria. So a very specific subset of all the people with diabetes who have chronic kidney disease. So I think this does actually expand things and actually helps us in some quite useful ways, as well as, of course, providing a drug that helps people with chronic kidney disease who don't have diabetes. You made an interesting point, again, focusing on the DAPA-CKD, about, you know, what's safe and what's not safe and when we should worry about that. There was actually quite a nice poster presentation from the Credence trial that I did look at, which looked at those patients who had acute drops in GFR after starting canagliflozin in the Credence trial, and showed actually that, you know, even if your eGFR dropped by 30% in the acute phase, you still actually ended up with the same benefits in the long term. And that's a really important clinical message, because sometimes when we start these drugs, we worry about the acute drop in GFR that can occur when you start an SGLT2 inhibitor. But if we know that even if it drops by 30%, in the long term, it's going to be fine, it will recover, and the outcomes will be better than somebody who never took the drug, then that's, I think, a really important message.
The only, you know, the only thing that I have a concern about, and there was actually a presentation about, you know, the people that are being diagnosed younger with diabetes and how risk factor management is actually not being done in that population. So one of the things I get really worried about is this is really amazing, amazing information in terms of, you know, keeping people with known complications safer and providing them, you know, longevity and reducing their morbidity and mortality. But I worry that, you know, we have such great evidence that we're going to lose the message around what really matters in the beginning of, and I'm going to go back to just diabetes. It's like, what really matters in the beginning? And we are all privileged to be able to sort of hear it and hear it from the experts. And probably for the case of, you know, John and Sanjay, you treat a lot of the people that would be the population of these studies. But what about, you know, if I'm in primary care and, you know, I didn't even adopt to using an SGLT2 inhibitor in my diabetes patients because I still thought about AKI and I still was worried about yeast infections and what about those amputations? And now when there's all this higher data, you know, I'm concerned that sometimes they'll be, well, now it's really a specialist drug. So now it's really the drug that the nephrologist is going to prescribe or the cardiologist is going to prescribe. And yet there's a call to action that, you know, glucose control matters. And these are still really good drugs for glucose control, never mind the weight loss and a little bit of blood pressure lowering. So it's very exciting to that group of patients that are, you know, that fit that portfolio. But we really need to maintain the message that there's still another reason to treat diabetes with these, and that's the glucose lowering. So I hope that message stays out there for prescribers.
You're right there, but if I could just come back on one point, because I think it's also important to make the point, and what these trials show is that the benefits actually go beyond the effect on glucose lowering. Because in fact, if your eGFR is 27, you don't really get much glucose lowering from an SGLT2 right. inhibitor, but it will stop you reduce your risk of developing kidney failure and requiring dialysis, and reduce your risk of ending up in hospital with heart failure or having a cardiovascular death. So these are really important outcomes that are actually independent of glucose lowering. So we kind of have to think about these drugs in two boxes now. We kind of have to think of them in the glucose lowering box, but also in the cardiovascular and renal protection box. And then for most of our patients, they fall into both, but for some of them, it's only actually going to be for the cardiovascular and renal protection that we're going to be prescribing the drug. And in fact, the glucose control may be very good, and we may actually be saying, well, actually, you can throw away the yeah. DPP-4 inhibitor because you don't really need it anymore. So that is a cost neutral switch, and that's a really useful way of using these drugs. So it's another thing to think about in practice, I would say.
The advantage of these studies is that they have actually made the diabetes management scenario more inclusive. Let's look at it from three points of view. Number one is the patient's point of view. Now, with DAPA-CKD, for example, if the data is accepted by the labeling authorities, by the regulators, the eGFR cutoff comes down to 25. For empagliflozin, it comes down to 20. So it's much safer for you to use, much safer for every primary care physician to use. Similarly, when you look at some of the participants who were included in DAPA-CKD or in EMPEROR heart failure, the eldest age has gone up till 94 years. So age is not a contraindication anymore. Yeah. Of course, you will not give to a frail elderly person, but if the person is active, the person is doing fairly well in terms of other aspects of health, you can go even up till 90s to prescribe this. So it's inclusive for every patient. Now, let's look at it from another point of view. You don't have to worry about the patient having diabetes. The patient can have diabetes. He or she can have impaired glucose tolerance or pre-diabetes. He or she can be pre-diabetic. In all of them, the drug is going to act. So that's another way in which it's inclusive. A third thing, instead of having different boxes about our target, is my target glucose lowering? Is my target CV risk reduction? Is my target renal risk reduction? Let me just put it all together and say metabolic optimization. So these are drugs for metabolic optimization. That's another way in which they're inclusive. And when we put all this together, it means they are drugs for everybody. Any healthcare professional who is dealing with metabolic ill health, whose aim is metabolic optimization, can use these drugs confidently. But like we said, and like Laurie said, remember that the primary aim is good health. Don't forget lifestyle modification. That will still be the framework and the foundation of all our treatment. And be aware of the caveats and contraindications. If we can just get this message across, I think things are much easier.
I want to just jump on one thing that John said too, and I think Sanjay, you said it as well, though, is that because we have been used to these as being glucose-lowering drugs, I think the idea that the message that as the EGFR drops, so does the glucose-lowering, is important for our non-diabetes colleagues to realize. Because I think one of the barriers to even using, say, you know, an SGLT2 inhibitor in someone with a previous cardiovascular event by a cardiologist was they didn't know what to do with the sulfonylurea or the insulin dose should they get glucose, hypoglycemia. So I do think that that is a really important takeaway message, is that, you know, not only are we able to prescribe safely down to a lower EGFR, despite the fact that there was so much worry about that when the first labeling came out, that if you have someone that you're concerned about because they have really great glucose control, but they have a poor EGFR, in fact, you're not going to put them at any risk of hypoglycemia. And I do think for our non-diabetes colleagues, that's an important message because that could be a barrier for prescribing. Yeah. So we talked a lot about this, that, you know, I'm just curious because I have the opportunity to hear from, you know, the two of you. We talked a lot about the renal part of these new SGLT2 trials, but, you know, what about the heart failure part of it? Is there sort of any sort of takeaway that I should have from that in terms of, you know, recognizing that, you know, this is an unthought of complication of diabetes. And now we have, you know, two trials that demonstrate it in both people with and without diabetes. But, you know, sort of what's the big takeaway from the heart failure part of it? That there's a lot of it out there and we're not treating it, that it's easier to treat, that you know, these are better drugs than some of the other ones. Like, I just wonder what you guys think about the heart failure. Yeah.
So the heart failure side of it is really difficult because I don't think at the moment anybody is advocating that we go out and we start screening everybody with type 2 diabetes with echocardiograms and BNP measurements and things. And of course, that's something that at some point might happen if we get a really good sensitive test for heart failure that can be widely applied. But I think what we should have is perhaps a lower clinical threshold for considering whether the patient might have heart failure. So if a patient walks into your surgery and looks a bit breathless, you know, ask some questions. Do they get breathless when they lie flat? Do they get more breathless on exertion than they do to? Have their ankles been swollen? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then maybe that's the time to start thinking about investigating them for heart failure and getting a cardiologist involved. And I think that's something that we in diabetes, we often just say, oh, maybe your ankle's a bit swollen because you're on a calcium channel blocker and you're breathless because you're overweight. And sometimes that might be the case, but we should always be thinking about heart failure in those situations. And because if you make that diagnosis, there are now treatments that can improve morbidity and mortality from it.
When we look at the staging or the grading of heart failure, it's divided into four grades, A, B, C, D. By default, anybody who is entering a diabetic clinic will already be in stage A. Stage A means there's a risk of heart failure. Stage B means there's a structural abnormality in the heart, but the patient doesn't have heart failure, at least not clinical heart failure. No symptoms, no signs, but there is subclinical disease in the form of structural heart disease. And many of our patients will have that. We don't get the echoes done for all of them, but a vast majority of our patients will have some amount of diastolic dysfunction at least. What these heart failure trials have done, like Emperor Reduced, what they've done is they've helped us focus upon the stage A and stage B. They've also told us that you can use these drugs in stage A and stage B in people with diabetes. And now even in people without diabetes, you can use them earlier on in the continuum of heart failure. Once you go to stage C and D, even then there's a role for these drugs because you can prevent repeat hospitalization. So of course, we will need more trials and more experience with this. Our colleagues in cardiology will finally tell us how early we can use these drugs in the course of preventing heart failure. But I think it's important to understand these. When we get non-invasive markers, cheaper markers for diagnosing heart failure, we do have BNP, pro-BNP, but they're expensive. Many people cannot afford them. When we get cheaper alternatives, I think the management of heart failure will become much, much more effective. We'll be able to prevent heart failure instead of just managing it.
I mean, that's a really good point, Sanjay, but I would just highlight a couple of things. Firstly, of course, both DAPA-HF and Emperor Reduced looked at patients who had reduced ejection fraction. And a lot of the patients with heart failure and diabetes have preserved ejection fraction.
Yeah.
And although we've got some analyses from studies like DECLARE that it's still not really clear to me that we have clear evidence of benefit in patients with preserved ejection fraction, but there is EMPEROR preserved. There is a dapagliflozin study looking at patients with preserved ejection fraction as well. So I think that's going to be the next step, if you like, in understanding the use of these drugs in heart failure, as to whether they're also effective in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, which is the majority of people that we see.
That's true. What John is saying is right, because we actually do not have any drug as of now, any drug, whether cardiotonic, whether glucocentric, which has been proven to improve outcomes in preserved ejection fraction. In fact, one glucose-lowering drug which comes quite close is pioglitazone. We tend to view pioglitazone as a drug which causes heart failure, but that's not right. Pioglitazone is a drug which can cause fluid retention. It actually improves the dynamics of the heart. It improves the structure and the function of the heart. So not to say that pioglitazone is a drug which should be used now in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, but the data is there, it's promising. And as we get more and more insights into the use of dapagliflozin and empagliflozin, I'm sure that will be the next frontier that will be conquered, maybe with the combination therapy. And then sacubitril valsartan, the ARNI, that's another drug which is a drug combination which has come up in the last few years. In many meetings, we speak about sequential versus simultaneous use of ARNIs and SGLT2 inhibitors. Few people have experience with this, but now with the data that has come out of the heart failure trials with DAPA and with EMPA, I think more and more of our colleagues in cardiology will get experienced with this, and that experience will be for the better. It will be for the better of betterment of everybody. But since Lori was speaking about hypoglycemia, there are changes also in the way we measure hypoglycemia now. Earlier, we just used to look at HbA1c in our trials. In ESD, did you find any change in the way trials are being conducted? What their endpoints are? Are they looking at hypoglycemia, nocturnal hypoglycemia, time in range?
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I mean, I think these are really interesting points. And we have seen, you know, this technology now that allows us to do continuous glucose monitoring or flash glucose monitoring. And we're now seeing some of the results of that coming out from clinical trials, either small trials in very specific populations like the Baratis trial, which looked at patients post-MI using continuous glucose monitoring, and found that when you use that tool, you get slightly more time in range, not statistically significant, but you get a lot less hypoglycemia, which is a big and important problem for people who are in hospital or who have recently had a myocardial infarction. So I think we are learning more and more about glucose variability and the importance of it as we use these tools. And I think there was some other data presented that looked at this with some of the newer glucose lowering drugs. Is that right, Laurie? I think you were talking about
that.
Well, yeah,
I think to add to what you're mentioning is that at the end of all of this is that we actually now have access to a reasonable tool that's accurate and available, you know, that we can use, that we can validate the claims that have been made that when we've advanced insulin therapies, that we believe that there's less glucose variability, and often that's been determined by a clamp study or whatever. But now when we actually have real randomized control trials that integrate this technology, we can have confidence that yes, in fact, that's exactly what's happening, and we can more adequately measure whether or not hypoglycemia is occurring. Because all of those years of doing, you know, new insulin trials where we got people to get up randomly at 3 a.m. to do an overnight check, what was the chances that we actually were at the right time, that we were potentially going to capture that overnight, you know, hypoglycemia? And even if they were, you know, 3.8 on that finger stick, or under 70 on that finger stick, were they really hypoglycemic, or were they just, you know, sort of floating down, but they didn't trend down under to 3.1 or 3.0. So I think that this has really been a great way to validate our current thinking, to say, yes, we can with confidence. And there were some insulin trials that looked at this, looking at time in range, looking at also episodes of hypoglycemia. And I think that as we move forward to having more time, devices that are accessible for people living with diabetes, and accessible is the operative word, that, you know, we probably will change our thinking in terms of what we're doing besides A1C lowering and reducing hypoglycemia. And in the real world, we'll start pivoting more and more to talking about the importance of keeping people in their range and then the resulting A1C that will come from that. So Sanjay, what do you think? Because I think you saw some of those sessions as well that talked about time and range as endpoints and validation.
Yeah, what I liked about all these sessions is most of them, you know, they compare one insulin preparation with another insulin preparation, or like in the case of Liberati's, they were just looking at a particular cohort of patients who had just had an MI. Time in range is a destination because it's a target. We want to achieve a 70% time in range in the average patient. But apart from being a target, it's also a tool. It's a tool to help us achieve that target. It's a technique also. It's a technique which helps us improve the quality of care that we prescribe. And to use a cricketing analogy, sorry, Lori, for that. But earlier, we used to talk about the glycemic sixer. In a glycemic sixer, you have three action-based points. You want to control fasting, postprandial, and HbA1c. And you also have three caution-based points. You want to minimize hypoglycemia, minimize nocturnal hypoglycemia, and minimize glycemic variability. So a glycemic sixer is like you send a batsman out to the crease, and the English just won their test series against the West Indies. So congrats, John, for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you have to have a batsman, and congrats, Elena and David as well. You have to have a batsman who can score sixes each time. That's the concept of sixer. But if that batsman knows that he is going to get a Yorker or a bouncer, then he just stays put. Then he doesn't try to score a run off that risky ball. He just waits for the next ball or for the next over. That's what we were trying in diabetes care. But now, since many people outside the Commonwealth don't like cricket, so now we've come up with the glycemic compass. The glycemic compass lets you go wherever you want. You can go north, you can go south, east, west. And that's what time in range does for us. But with all these trials, one nice thing that I saw was that irrespective of what insulin that was being used, almost all insulins were able to take their participants to more than 70% of time in range, which means we can actually do a good job of controlling glucose if we want to. If we were to spend the same energy on our OPD patients that we spend on our clinical trial participants, I'm sure life would be much easier for everyone. In specific, I was looking at three trials which talked about once weekly insulin, Icotec, and that was interesting. Any insights on that, John?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a little bit of a skeptical about the one once weekly insulin, because I've worried exactly about that, about hypoglycemia. And I've actually been, you know, quite pleasantly surprised that the results are actually quite good. I'm still a little bit nervous, but I can see that it does have potential.
Well, I have two things I want to say. I'll comment on the once weekly insulin. And you know what hasn't been clear to me is it looks great, and less insulin dosing, similar glycemic control. These are early stages. And so we are in basically phase two trials, which we all know are pretty controlled trials. It'll be interesting because I think that the real world, the big question will be, what happens if my patient gets sick? And they have a sustained illness, and they have this long-acting basal insulin on board. And obviously, the trials right now that we have heard about are in type 2 diabetes, which makes really good sense that that's the place to start, because we have a lot of questions about whether or not this would ever be suitable for individuals living with type 1 diabetes. And maybe that's kind of not really fair to say, because there's a lot of people that live with type 2 diabetes who live very active lives and have, you know, do intense exercise as well. And so there's always that question about these newer, longer basal insulins and whether or not my patient who is, you know, an extreme athlete is safe when they take their regular insulin dose, like what happens. And there's always the question about stacking. And so there's going to be a lot of questions that need to be answered. Yeah. With the once weekly, but I think the real life scenarios will really need to be very clear for people to have confidence. Yes, the adherence will be easy. Yes, reducing it to 52 weeks in a year and 300 versus 365 shots. So you have 52 versus 365. So that's all very appealing and similar glycemic control. But when we think about who actually will prescribe this in a day-to-day practice, there'll be a lot of questions that will need to be answered for confidence. I just want to come back to time and range for a second, because one of the things I think that's really interesting is that people are talking about time and range as an outcome that we're, you know, we're trying to achieve 70%, and it'll give us a better A1C. And there's been a lot of extrapolation from looking back on bigger trials, even trials like DEVOTE and some of the large cardiovascular outcome trials, and determining time and range from the 7-point profiles, and then, you know, suggesting that there's a reduction in micro and macrovascular complications. And I think that that's really good, but there was something at EASD about looking at microvascular complication progression with reduction or improvement in time and range. And I think it'll be nice to have some prospective work with time and range and reduction in complications, because it's the extrapolation, and really 7-point profiles are kind of an interesting way to extrapolate it. But I do think that we're going to start to get more and more data as we use this technology in the bigger trials. So I wonder what you guys feel about that in terms of the benefit to our patient besides the day-to-day glucose management and a better A1C.
Quality of data is going up, certainly, and we'll have better things in future. Regarding Icodec, Icodec would certainly not be an insulin for an unstable patient, a severely symptomatic patient, a patient who is at risk of getting into DKA or hyperosmolar coma, somebody with a clinically significant medical or surgical or obstetric comorbidity. But it will be a good option for someone who is stable. And the data that has been presented, 3 pivotal trials, they tell us that you can get very good control with better SMBG results with less insulin dose as compared to once daily insulin. They also discuss about various titration regimens, and they find the advantages and disadvantages between various titration regimens. I think the one that came out best was a plus minus 28 unit per week titration regimen. And then they also look at loading versus non-loading. But the point that you raised about time and range, and also about maybe somebody going on a fast or somebody having to fast because of an intercurrent illness. So, you know, Laurie, I went on intermittent fasting for 18 days. And I was very faithful. I was a good patient. And I ended up gaining 400 grams. I realized actually, yeah, when you read the physiology, even if you fast for a week, at the most, you will go into ketosis. If you're a type 2 diabetic, as long as you're not type 1, you're not going to go into ketoacidosis to fast, provided you're drinking enough water. So even if Icodec is given as administered, and let us say the patient decides to go on a 7-day fast by choice or not by choice, I don't think there's going to be hypo. The liver is going to take care of the basal glucose needs. And at the end of 7 days, you still might have a stable fasting glucose. So that shouldn't be a major issue. Time in range, coming back to what you asked, time in range is quite interesting, quite exciting. And we need to, I think, just wait for better data to come out.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think that but the reality at the moment in clinical practice is that these tools are mostly used for people with type 1 diabetes, and most of us don't use flash glucose monitoring or continuous glucose monitoring in people with type 2 diabetes outside of, you know, the clinical research setting. As the costs come down, and you know, and they will, because these things always do, as the technology develops and the competition comes in, I think we will start seeing people with type 2 diabetes, especially starting with those who are treated with insulin, using these technologies. And I think one thing I would say about these technologies, and one of the reasons why I think they're so powerful as a clinician, is that they really do empower the patient, the person with diabetes, to manage their own condition in a way that they just haven't been able to before. And the number of people that I see who say, you know, I just never understood, you know, because they're looking at these 4 points or 5 points during the course of the day, and they've got no idea what's happening in between, whether it's on its way up or whether it's on its way down. And now they can see these graphs, they can see these patterns. It suddenly, it's like a light bulb, and they understand their diabetes. And then they can, with the right support and education, make the changes that they need to make to improve their glucose control, which is what we want them to do and what they want to do usually.
Yeah, I was going to say though, John, wouldn't it also be safe to say that we didn't actually really understand their diabetes before either? That we were pretty good.
Yeah.
Laurie, you're not supposed to tell anybody that. That's the best secret of the end.
No, I actually,
of the entire diabetes care fraternity.
I think that's absolutely fantastically really important comment.
But I actually like to, you know, especially with people living with diabetes, when I talk about a reason for them to adapt into this newer technology, I'll often put my vulnerability out there saying, I used to think I was really good at adjusting people's insulin and that I could tell you exactly what was going on until people started to come back having worn this device. And I was like, ooh, I was completely wrong, you know. So I think it's been a big learning curve, mostly because with the introduction of flash glucose monitoring, we've seen more people be able to access it. So not only have more patients accessed it, but then more healthcare professionals have started to get familiar with it. Whereas more of the, you know, sort of traditional continuous glucose monitoring have only been in specialty care and in a select group of people. So I think that the eye opening of what really is happening in diabetes management has occurred for healthcare professionals as well that haven't been exposed. So yeah, I do think that there's nothing like the person who tries it and tells you exactly what they figured out, you know, and it's like, you didn't need me at all. But when you need me, you're right, John. I think that we should remind ourselves that there's a lot of data there. I worry about the data tsunami. I worry about, you know, people really overreacting to what they see because they do have so much information and starting to, you know, chase it with more insulin or, you know, or trying to figure out, you know, how to manage. And that's why my big comment to people always is just wear it, you know, just wear it for a week or so. Don't start making a lot of, overcompensation.
Yeah.
Learn from it. But the arrows are brilliant, right? Anything that gives you a downward trend arrow prevents hypoglycemia, and that's magic all by itself.
One thing where it's been incredibly useful for us has been, you know, with all this COVID, we're doing almost entirely remote consultations now, and our patients can just upload the data and we can have that conversation over the phone in a way that we could never do before. So it has actually sort of enabled safe diabetes care without even actually having to meet with patients face to face, which has been really useful.
We all are lucky, actually. You know, we have access to so much technology, such good devices for diagnosis, screening, monitoring, such good drugs for treatment. So I wonder how our peers or people who came before us worked. Insulin is 100 years old now. Next year, we celebrate a centenary.
Yeah.
And DCCT was launched about 30 years ago. I was a student in internal medicine when the DCCT results came out. And that was the first time, actually, that we had proof that you could reduce complications with good glucose control in type 1 diabetes. And then UKPDS came out after that. Then we had proof for type 2 diabetes as well. And I remember then at that time, I was a student in endocrinology. And when the UKPDS data came out, there were people who were reading the results in different ways. There were some people who were saying, we have proof, we are on the right path. And there were others who were saying, there's no point in controlling glucose in type 2 diabetes. You're not going to be able to do anything about macrovascular complications. So just sit at home and relax. Let your patient's glucose go high. Now it's 30 years since DCCT. And there was data at the ESD presented from a 30-year follow-up point of view. And data shows that you can actually have a robust reduction, not only in micro, but also in macrovascular complications, even 3 decades after having been in an intensive control arm. So the people who were in the intensive control arm in DCCT are still reaping the benefits 3 decades later. And those who had the misfortune to go into a conventional therapy arm are still suffering from the side effects of unwanted exposure to glucose. And then in ESD, we had an explanation for that as well. They talk about genetics and epigenetics. They talk about a genetic epigenetic cycle. So Laurie, what's your comment on that? How can we motivate our patients, both type 1 and type 2, to do their best?
Oh, you know what? I'm a big fan of informed choices. So I think that, you know, when we can have the conversation that helps people understand that what they do today makes a difference down the road and why we know that, And then remind them of the tools that we have in the toolbox to be able to facilitate that. But I do think it's our responsibility to make sure that people understand why this is important. And we have to really change the mindset of many individuals, not so much those treating type 1 diabetes, which is obviously primarily in specialty care where people know this. But a lot of type 2 diabetes is managed initially and for the long term in primary care. And to your point, you know, the UKPS message of, as you said, just sit home and let your patient's glucose go high, is that we still talk about it's just a touch of diabetes, it's still borderline diabetes, and, you know, that we are not aggressive in early management. So I think that we just have more and more evidence as to why we should help individuals living with diabetes to understand what happens today predicts your future. But also the people who care for them really need to hear this information, that we can make a difference in the long run. And unfortunately, around the world, type 2 diabetes is being diagnosed so much earlier. I mean, I'm from the epicenter of pediatric type 2 diabetes in the First Nation population, and we're seeing it diagnosed in children that are 6 and 10 years of age, and you know, the escalation of those complications. So early control matters needs to be everybody's understanding. How about you, John? What do you think of all that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, but I think these scientific explanations around genetics and epigenetics are really interesting, and I'm sure that that is part of the mechanism. But to be honest, I think the really important thing is the kind of the area under the curve of the glucose. In other words, you know, if your average glucose over 10, 20, 30 years of diabetes is lower, you're going to come out of it a healthier person, and if we can just keep, you know, using all the tools we have to support people, as Laurie says, informed choice and education is really, really important, and so that the people with diabetes can actually, you know, take control of their own lives with our support, then that's the way we should be going.
Along with informed choice, we have to ensure information equipoise, which means that we have access to a lot of information and we are the privileged ones. We get to attend ESD, we get to speak with each other, learn from each other. Just the very fact that I'm conversing with John and Laurie, that opens up the buds in my brain. And I assume it would be true for all of us who are listening to this podcast. But many of our patients are not privileged enough. Many of our colleagues also don't have access to all this knowledge. So if we can create information equipoise between ourselves and the patient, then it makes the job of getting an informed and shared decision-making much easier. In Eastern philosophy, and this would be, I think, useful for countries across the world, in Eastern philosophy, we have the concept of karma. Karma means, it's a Sanskrit word, K-A-R-M-A, but it's part of the English dictionary as well. So that is what you did in your previous existence. The karma or the actions that you did in your previous existence influence what you are going through today, and the actions that you perform today will influence what you will experience in your next existence. But we speak with patients and tell them that you don't have to worry about previous lives or future lives. It's within this very life. Whatever actions you took 10 or 20 years ago, whether you smoked tobacco, whether you took care of your blood pressure or lipids or glucose or weight or not, whether you exercised or not, whether you ate that McDonald's burger or not, that has influenced what you are going through today. How your HbA1c is, how your quality of life is. But whatever you do today is going to influence your health tomorrow. That is what we get from the cardiovascular outcome trials. And that is also what we get from the DCCT follow-up or the UKPDS follow-up or advance on. So when we explain this philosophy to them, then they get motivated to work today, to work along with the healthcare professional for a better tomorrow. And that work is what we are all trying to explain to them. Lifestyle modification along with comprehensive metabolic optimization.
Thank you to Sanjay, John and Laurie, and thank you for listening. Please visit diabetes.medicinematters.com for more information and opinion on these topics and other aspects of caring for people with diabetes.